This hour of the Jason Rand Show is brought to you by You Build It. There's a lot of news happening all around the world and right here at home. So let's find out what's trending.
What's trending at home?
We heard earlier this week the new public charge, the change in how certain immigration policies are going to move forward as it relates to people who are trying to gain visas to stay in the United States. New rules coming from the Trump administration. Well, how are the locals reacting? Joining me in studio is our friend Aaron Granilla from our sister station, Cairo Radio. Let me guess. Seattle-based officials are freaking out and offering not data, but anecdotes.
So some Washington healthcare providers that I spoke out to, they are offering some fears, essentially. So again, to recap what you just said, the public charge rule sort of broadens the scope of who would be considered a public charge, someone who would be considered to be a burden on our...
Would be too reliant on different social programs.
Yes. So it's saying now programs like Medicaid and food stamps, if you rely on those for a certain amount of time... you have a less likely chance to either gain access to the country or get a green card. That is worrisome to Chris Casa. He is with the Washington Association for Community Health.
We do observe this chilling effect. Folks who are not clear on the details of this extremely complicated new rule, who figure that it's better to be safe than sorry and forego some of the help that they need and would be entitled to.
So there is some anecdotal evidence that this is already happening across the country, including at Seattle's International Community Health Services. Aaliyah Hawk is their nutrition services supervisor.
I actually see the effect of it firsthand. I had a lot of patients coming and asking us to remove them because they just didn't want anything that they're doing for immigration to be affected. Remove all the whole family from all medical, dental, and everything. A dad literally begged me to do that.
And she shared another story about a woman who came in with a sick daughter.
Mm-hmm.
The woman said that she qualified for Medicaid but chose to pay instead because she didn't want to go on Medicaid, fearing that as she tries to gain legal status in this country, that would work against her. So these are some of the stories that healthcare clinics who provide low-income care, some of the stories that they're sharing. Now,
so they know the immigration status of the people that they're treating here?
They don't.
Because that is an important part of this conversation.
Right.
Because the public charge, which, by the way, is not new. Now, arguably, the Trump administration is defining it somewhat differently.
Sure.
But, I mean, this has been in place since like the 1880s
right,
or something.
Late 19th century.
This is nothing new. And generally, the way it was used back then was you have to have some sort of financial means to take care of yourself, because what we don't want to do is bring in potentially hundreds of thousands of people every single year who are going to be a financial burden, particularly if we think a recession is coming. Mm. So the timing of this kind of makes sense from that perspective. But it's not about people who are in this country illegally. These
right.
are people who are very specifically trying to go for visas.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Now, it's interesting you brought up the economic argument, because I did ask, some of these healthcare providers, does the U.S. government have a responsibility to make sure that when it brings people here or gives green cards to certain people, that they can, in the government's words, stand on their own two feet? They countered by saying, well, no, for one. And then they also said, if you take away certain services like Medicaid, it's actually going to be more of a drain, their argument, on state services like emergency rooms, because they're going to get sick and they're going to need care. And if it's not through Medicaid, it's going to either be through ER. They're fearful that, pregnant women, for instance, might not want to come forward and will have home births. So there, again, are these fears.
None of which is borne out by actual data, though.
There is no data to support any of these fears. But again, there is anecdotal evidence. And the reason, of course, there's no data is because when people come to these clinics, they don't ask for legal status, right? That's not one of the requirements for getting care at these low-income clinics.
There's a lot of misinformation on the public charge. It does not automatically mean that hundreds of thousands of people are not going to gain access to a visa. It does not mean that they're automatically going to lose anything at all. When they're talking about the public charge, they're being very specific to show that there is more proof than not that the individual is not going to be in a permanent status of relying on social programs. That is not an unreasonable position. Even, I would argue, for Democrats here, if the goal is to just keep bringing folks in who are going to rely on government assistance, then at that point, why do we have a program at all for immigration? Let's just open the border and just get, that's just not sustainable.
I believe the new rule says if you are relying on services for 12 months in aggregate, so for a total of 12 months within a 36-month period, then you are less likely to get a green card.
Now, less likely, but not impossible.
Not impossible, correct. It will count against you. There are other factors, things like age, if you already have health insurance.
Well, health status, financials.
Right.
That's, again, but that's also something that was put into place. It was not considered controversial in 1996 when Republicans were not in the White House.
Yeah, what's controversial now is the fact that the administration is broadening who would be who would fall under the microscope.
What's mostly controversial, I would argue, is the fact that Trump's name is attached to it. And when he does anything, there is always this pushback. I haven't heard any of the same voices say anything positive of anything that the president has done. There's always this initial pushback and all the fear-mongering stuff. Well, you're not providing any data, folks. Give us some data, and then I think we can have a reasonable conversation about what all of this means, but they don't have the data on their side. They're just saying, oh, well, this could happen. Well, yeah, lots of things. You know what also could happen? None of what you're suggesting, right? Everything that they're suggesting might not happen at all.
There are it has been happening.
They say that.
Yeah, they say it's been happening.
How many did you speak to?
I spoke to the man who's in charge of
the individuals who have decided to.
I tried to reach out to individuals.
And you're going to keep trying, and yeah. maybe you'll get one person who you won't be able to verify any of the facts that they're telling you. I'm just wondering how much of this is creating a narrative because they don't like the new rule definition, which again, that's a valid and very reasonable conversation to have. What's not reasonable is pretending that because they have a couple anecdotes, that none of which can be proven, that means any sort of reality on the ground.
Sure. And we should also note, part of the policy, refugees and asylum seekers would not be affected by this policy, nor would pregnant women or children.
Which, again, very, very important to point out, because we hear a whole bunch of people, including in your anecdote, right, of, a woman who's got a kid not going to take the kid in. Like, but that has nothing. Then that's on you guys who are providing the services to say,
make it clear.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're not going to be impacted by this at all. Yeah. This is not about you. This is not about hurting kids. It's not about hurting mothers. There's nothing that's even being discussed that would do that. Yeah. But they'll use that as a story about the fear mongering.
Yeah, and to be fair, the Washington Community Health Association is reaching out to its clinics and providing information for them to deliver to patients saying, hey, you don't, if you're a pregnant woman, for instance, if you rely on WIC, those programs like those are not going to be affected. They're relaying this information to them. And of course, as we know, Washington's Attorney General, Bob Ferguson.
Is he going to sue? Oh, what?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, leading a coalition.
That is rare.
13 states trying to block.
Is he actually leading the coalition, or is he saying he's leading the coalition because it looks better on a press release?
I honestly
don't know the answer to that.
He actually is leading the coalition of 13 states. Yes.
Again, that's so totally rare. He doesn't do. When was the last time he did? Oh, Tom's in my last week.
Do you want to hear from Bob Ferguson?
Yeah, one quick clip.
Frankly, this public charge rule forces legally present immigrant families into a terrible choice. Either continue their dream to become Americans or provide health care, food, or a roof over their children's heads. That's not a choice anyone should have to make.
And he calls
I thought it doesn't impact children. He just said it did.
Well, it would impact families.
Come on,
Who have children.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that's not what he just said. He said something a little bit different, didn't he?
Well, sure. He's an elected official.
What?
They all spin, don't they?
Well, he spins a lot in one particular direction, but I guess you're right. That is what he does.
Yeah.
All this information right now is available at MyNorthwest.com. That's our parent website. Aaron Granillo from our sister station, Cairo Radio, thanks for stopping by. Yeah. It's always fun giving you a hard time.
Love it. I'll do it anytime you'd like.
Yes! You're listening to The Jason Rad Show. Don't forget, you can follow me on Instagram. Just search for the screen name Jason Rantz. Fire up the Instagram app, add Jason Rantz, go behind the scenes of the show, the studio, and you'll see tonight when I'm on Q13 Fox at 8:30, I'll take you on a little bit of a tour there as well. So add me on Instagram under Jason Rantz. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending at the movies?
It's Friday. You know what that means? It means I get to talk about movies thanks to our sponsor, Alpine Specialty Cleaning at alpineclean.com. Good Boys is out now, and it's a very R-rated comedy featuring tweens. And because they're all 12, 13 years old, swearing up a storm throughout the entire movie, producer Seth Rogen sets up the trailer this way.
Hey, kids. As you know, I am one of the producers on your movie, Good Boys, and unfortunately, I'm here with bad news. You guys cannot watch the trailer for your own movie.
What? Are you
Come
serious?
On.
Are you kidding?
It's just too messed up for kids your age. There's drugs, there's violence, there's swearing, and although we've decided it's okay for you to do these things in the movie, you can't watch yourselves do them in the trailer. Oh, it is f***ed up.
Yeah.
You can say that.
Yeah.
You can't watch yourself say that.
So Good Boys is about three best friends in sixth grade trying to learn how to kiss before a kissing party that night. But they get in trouble when they use a drone to spy on their neighbors in an effort to see how kissing is done.
We're sorry. We just want to learn how to kiss.
We'll kiss.
It's none of their business.
We should have just told the truth. We're going to a kissing party and none of us have ever kissed and we're scared.
Lucas, I've had sex before, but I've never kissed a girl.
Look, can we please have the drone back? If you don't give it back, I'll tell my dad you stole it.
And I'll tell him that you're a pervert.
We'll tell the whole school.
This is sensual harassment.
We'll tell everyone that you're a misogynist.
I never massaged anyone.
This is what happens when you don't respect women.
I respect women. My mom's my best friend.
About me.
So ultimately, it becomes a movie about friendships and bonds and really growing apart. And despite the vulgar jokes, and by the way, they're very funny vulgar jokes, this film is like weirdly charming and utterly adorable. This is a comedy with heart, and if you take away all of the F-bombs, it's still a sweet movie. The three lead characters absolutely make this film. When you've got kid actors, they usually make or break a movie, and each of them is unique, oddly complex, and really fun to watch. The clever part about this movie, these are genuinely good kids. Despite what some might think based upon all of their swearing, these characters are literally good boys. They view drug use as immoral. One is disgusted by abortion. They're disgusted by sex. Ironically, this movie would be good for sixth graders. But it's R-rated, so they actually can't see it alone. The rating is based almost exclusively on language. Beyond that, I'd say it's actually appropriate for 13-year-olds. Just know that there's legitimately a ton of cussing in this movie. I absolutely loved Good Boys, and I highly recommend it. The other movie out right now is based on the wildly popular book, Where'd You Go, Bernadette? It's about a Seattle-based quirky architect trying to survive in a world where she stopped being creative. She stopped creating the brilliant work that she's known for, and as a result, it's taken a toll not just on her life, but also her family, threatening to tear her marriage apart.
You know what, LG doesn't know is that I am still obsessing about LA.
What do you mean?
You know, just last night, right? I woke up to pee. You know, I'm half asleep. I'm a blank slate. And then the data starts reloading. It's Bernadette Fox, 20 Mile House, destroyed, failed.
Yeah.
And it's like failure has got its teeth in me and it won't stop shaking.
You done?
Yeah.
Yeah, good, because I know you can't honestly believe any of this nonsense. As amusing as it is, it obscures the larger point, which is that people like you must create. That's what you were brought into this world to do, Bernadette. If you don't, you become a menace to society. I think there's one very simple answer to all of your problems. Get your ass back to work and create something.
Unfortunately, this movie is an absolute chore to watch. The performances, I think, are mostly strong, but the movie feels aimless and weirdly lifeless at times. It's a comedy where you don't actually laugh. It feels like it wants to be this whimsical comedy, but there's no whimsy. There's no actual comedy, and consequently, you end up not really caring as much about their struggles as you probably should. I mean, is Bernadette quirky or is she mentally ill? That's a legitimate question. Should we feel good about a relationship with her daughter, which is her biggest fan, worried about her future? Why is this movie being made exactly? What exactly is it trying to say? These are questions I kept asking myself during the movie, and I still don't have an answer. It feels directionless, but also cluttered. There's no surprises. And at times, I felt the story to be incoherent. I just didn't understand some of the scenes. I haven't read the book. But people who have say this movie is completely mishandled based upon the source material. And it kind of feels that way. And I'm saying that from the perspective of a guy who didn't actually read the book. It feels mishandled. Where'd You Go, Bernadette? It's out right now. It's a total mess, and I do not recommend it. What movie are you going to see this weekend? Send me a text on the Numb Better Tax Resolution hotline. 1-800-465-8770. Another film coming out this weekend is Blinded by the Light. We're actually going to talk about the film from the perspective of the guy who not just wrote it, but wrote it based on his own life. Sansour Mansour is going to stop by at 5:30. But before that, let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending in Seattle?
Amazon opened a new brick and mortar store. A new brick and mortar store that is going to potentially change the landscape, not just in Seattle, but all across the country. This is a store that will only sell, quote unquote, 4-star items, the types of items that Amazon, based upon the data that they have access to, is or knows is most likely going to sell.
This is an interesting grouping of products across categories. What they have in common is that they're all things that are very commonly found on wish lists on Amazon.com. So as an extension of our online partner, we are trying to bring in that shopping experience right here into the store. And that's the one way we know people like to shop, what's on a wish list.
So the reason why this is so important to see whether or not this works is you've got companies out there like Best Buy. Best Buy owns a whole bunch of land, right? They have these massive stores and they're filled with a whole bunch of products that generally don't get sold, right? When you walk in, some of the stuff that you see there has been there for years in some cases. And yes, they will cycle stuff in and out, but that is not very cost effective, right? It's not very efficient. It's not an efficient use of their time or their money. Amazon has access to all of this data based on how people spend online. They know what's going to sell. And so they put it out there and they're spending less time and energy and not having to spend as much money buying the property for these products. That means they're going to be more, generally speaking, effectively and efficiently run, which puts even more stress on companies like Best Buy. A whole bunch of people who spoke to our sister station, Cairo Radio, went down to the new Amazon 4-star store in, this is quite, I guess it's downtown Seattle / South Lake Union. It's kind of in the middle of both of those neighborhoods. And they were super pumped.
I came in here not knowing what to expect, but my expectations were blown away. I'm finding things I didn't know I needed.
Such as?
A surge protector with built-in USB charging and a dustbuster, portable dustbuster.
So that's also how good. So when you're getting stuff put in front of you that other people want, and you kind of know that other people want it, then all of a sudden you want it. And so now you're more likely to spend some money on those things. I'm going to try to go tomorrow, assuming they're open on the weekend, so I'm excited about this. But really what I want you to be reminded of when we talk about these types of stories is, number one, it's good news, right? It's good news because this is a local company doing even better and taking over another aspect of the world. And again, it's local. We like that. But number two, and more importantly, they've not yet implemented the technology in this particular case yet, but they've got technology that allows people to just take things off of shelves and then just walk out and have it automatically deducted from their checking account associated with their Amazon app. They're going to eventually put that in a store like this. And think about what that means for the workers. So now, not only do they need less workers to put the product actually on the shelves because there's less product, because they're being so specific with what they're stocking at these stores, but they don't even need anyone to be a cashier. What's been happening over the course of the last several years? Bunch of unions going out there demanding $15, $20, $30 an hour. And instead, they're getting that in some cases. Here in Seattle, they got it. But instead of actually focus on the actual root causes of what's going to be a problem in the future, which is this kind of technology to automate them out of a job, they're still being focused on financial wins. It's not going to mean anything if they don't have the jobs to fill. 1-800-465-8770. If you want to send me a text on the Numb Better Tax Resolution hotline, 1-800-465-8770. Welcome back to the Jason Rancho on AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. If you love Bruce Springsteen, you're definitely going to love the brand new movie. It's out now. It's called Blinded by the Light. But even if you don't like Bruce Springsteen, this movie is the epitome of a feel-good film. It's based on a memoir by Safraz Mansour, who actually joins me in studio to talk about Blinded by the Light. Safraz, thank you so much for coming in.
No, it's great to talk to you.
So, Blinded by the Light, I always feel weird giving a rundown of a movie in front of someone who was involved in the movie for fear that I might skip something that's deeply important. So I will let you describe the film.
Okay, so basically, it's the fall of 1987. I'm 16 years old. And up to that point, I've been really a top 40 music kid. We were just chatting off air and you told me that you didn't think the music on the 80s.
80s was any... is the worst music ever.
So, I mean, you're wrong, obviously. So I was really into the 80s. I was into Madonna. I was into Michael Jackson. I was into the Pet Shop Boys. I was into Aha. You know, great stuff. But essentially, music that's kind of pointless. As in, it doesn't, it's not actually about anything. It's escapist. And so when I got introduced to Springsteen at the age of 16, suddenly I kind of felt like, my God, this guy's actually talking about real things. And I think that's what really spoke to me, because I grew up in a very working class town. My dad worked in a factory. I didn't get on particularly well with him. And I had normally used music to forget about these things, but Springsteen was talking about those very things. And I think that's what connected me to him.
Well, and there was a good part of the movie, a scene where that basically said, he doesn't speak to you. He doesn't speak about things that we understand.
People like us. He doesn't
speak
to people like us.
And that could have meant, of course, in that context was teenagers in high school in the United Kingdom, a Pakistani-American. So what was it about the lyrics that really spoke to you? Do you remember that one song that you first connected with?
I mean, Thunder Road, from the album Born to Run, the last line of Thunder Road is, it's a town full of losers and I'm pulling out of here to win. Now, Luton, which is where I grew up, a couple of years after I lived there, was voted the crappiest town in the country.
Nice. Congratulations. Dubious honor.
It's a dubious honor. And so that when I listened to that song, I was like, I had no idea Bruce Springsteen had been to Luton. It just felt like an absolute connection. Do you know what I mean? But also, this is a guy who came from those places and had gotten out. And his dad had worked at a factory. So I just thought, this was not just music that represented and reflected the life I led. It also suggested that there was a better life out there. And that was also quite inspiring to me.
When you ended up going to New Jersey and visiting the hometown of
on
Bruce
a pilgrimage, yeah. Pilgrimage.
Did it meet the expectations?
You know, the expectation that you probably have in that is, you know what, it was an absolute dump when I got there and I'd always imagined it was going to be amazing. It wasn't. It was absolutely amazing. Yeah. I was there on the New Jersey boardwalk, on the Asbury Park boardwalk. I was there at the Stone Pony. I was there at the convention center. And as somebody for whom, you know, this stuff had meant so much to me in my mind, it was amazing to actually be there.
So the movie Blinded by the Light, it's out right now in theaters. Highly recommend it. Love it. Obviously, it's about your love affair with Bruce Springsteen and what it meant to you at that time. And I'm curious if in 1987, the economy was doing well, your father doesn't get laid off, things are not struggling the way that they were, would you have fallen in love with Bruce Springsteen in the same way?
For me, the connection is as much about class and about fathers. You know, if you come from a working class kind of ordinary background, I think his music speaks specifically to that. And that doesn't matter whether it's in, you know, Seattle or in Pittsburgh or Philadelphia or in Britain. And I also think that, you know, he was somebody who really talked incredibly honestly about his relationship with his dad. And that stuff, you know, who doesn't have some kind of an issue with their parents, you know, especially if you're a teenager. So that stuff's kind of universal. So I think he would have probably spoken to me regardless.
Well, and obviously a part of this movie, we were talking about this beforehand, you know, clearly the identity side of things, the cultural differences of someone who emigrated was it directly to Luton when you were 3 years old?
Yes. Yeah.
So for the most part, that's the only thing you probably remember about
my memory begins in Britain.
Yeah. And so from that perspective, dealing with incredible bigotry in this particular city, in the UK in general, especially around that time, your father constantly saying, you're not British, you're Pakistani. So how do you identify?
Now, I mean, I identify as British. I mean, I kind of identified as British then, but it just felt like it was a sort of, it was harder to get that grip on that identity, you know? I'm married now, I've got kids. So in that sense, I feel more locked in. I also feel that some part of it is about, you know, where do you contribute and who has given you those opportunities? So the way I look at it is everything that I am, every opportunity I've had, everything that I've ever done has been in Britain. It's because of that. And then also, everything that I've created, you know, as a journalist, as an author, I've written a memoir called Greetings from Berry Park. That's all been about this, well, about Britain as well.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, that's who's given me the opportunities, and that's the country to which I have given everything as well. So in that sense, there is no other place for me.
Was it difficult for your family at the time and other, you know, folks who are family friends sort of taking on that identity as a Brit where, and I think the movie does a really good job of sort of not just highlighting the bigotry, but also sort of the downplaying of the bigotry that your a family friend faced. And it was like, okay, we don't really want to admit that this is what's going on here, but it's clearly going on.
Yeah, but you know, the thing about racism and bigotry and things like that is there's a spectrum to them, you know? So there is things like somebody spitting in your face and that sort of stuff. But there's also the thing about what you're allowed to dream about, what you're allowed to aspire to. So for me, it wasn't really the direct discrimination that particularly concerned me. It's more just what you're allowed to dream.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a 16-year-old growing up in a working-class town like Luton, you can't imagine that you'll do anything interesting with your life. You can't really imagine, you know, in the film, my character wants to be a writer. If you had met me at the age of 16, I wouldn't have said that because I couldn't have even believed it was possible to be a writer.
Yeah.
So that for me is interesting, is that you grow up and you think, I can't imagine being on TV. I can't imagine being on the radio. I can't imagine being a writer. I can't imagine a life that doesn't involve drudgery because I haven't seen anybody who vaguely looks like me doing anything like that. And for me, that's a slightly more pernicious and more depressing version of discrimination than the person who calls you a name on the street.
How close to the memoir is the movie?
So the book covers a lot of time. So it covers right from coming to Britain right through to my 30s. And the memoir, that's the memoir. The film just covers 2 years. And in a way, when I was thinking about the script for the film, I was just like, well, I can't do some massive kind of, you know, sprawling odyssey
yeah.
of a film. So let's just cut to the chase. Let's just cut to the bit, which is when I found out about Springsteen. So let's make it a rites of passage, coming of age film, 16 to 18, just before I start college, right through to Bruce, just before I go to uni. So it kind of, it only covers 2 years in that time, but a lot of the backstory about the parents mm-hmm. and everything, I sort of squeezed the chronology so that you could get some sense
yeah.
of who they are, even in those 2 hours.
So when you do something like that, when you basically have to self-edit, right? And not only just self-edit, but it's a movie that's supposed to be the most entertaining and dramatic parts, I suppose, of a story. How do you know where to start specifically, what to keep out or what to condense or maybe even what to embellish a little bit just for the sake of film?
Well, the book came out in 2007 and is now 2019. And part of it was changing the name of the character. You know,
why'd you do that?
Why did I do it? Because I found it hard to make it up. I kind of found it hard to not stick to the truth when the character was called my name.
Mm-hmm.
Because just mentally, it's just a little bit harder. So basically, I called him Javed. And the reason I'm calling him Javed is because that's my name before it was called Safraz. My mum used to call me that. And she still calls me that. If I go home, she still calls me Javed. But when I called him Javed, I was able to do things. Like, for example, he's got a girlfriend in the film. I didn't have a girlfriend when I was 16. My dad would have completely slaughtered me. So that's an example. You know, there are Javed in the film is much braver than I really was. So that's an example to answer your question about what you embellish and what you add. In truth, I would have been way too nervous. I would have been way too deferential to argue with my dad. So in the film, he confronts his dad and he has these really powerful arguments where he's really open-hearted and demands. I didn't do any of that. But that just felt more dramatic in the film. There's a scene towards the end where there's a speech that he gives in a college, and it's a really honest, heartfelt, emotional speech. It was organic, but it was also honest.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing. It's like, I think this is a film that's been made with love and honesty. So that speech, Gurinder Chadha, the director, she basically said to me, when you write these, that speech, literally just say what you think. Literally just say what you think to mm-hmm. the world. Yeah. And we'll just put it in Javed's mouth. So that was literally like my, how I see the world myself now as a 48-year-old, how I see the world. And I just put it in his mouth. And the other part of that is, you know, I've had a lot of people at screenings and preview screenings who come up to me afterwards and they've been in tears. And a lot of them are guys because I think it's sort of, it has got a father-son yep. kind of dynamic going on. And the interesting thing, which is not sort of in the film, but like the film finishes in 1989. And 6 years later, which is in the memoir, my dad died of a heart attack
wow.
very quickly, very suddenly, without, you know, without any warning. And I was only 23 years old. And that meant that I never had that kind of closure of a relationship in terms of getting to know him as a human being and talking to him about what his life was like and understanding the ways that we're connected. So in real life, I never got to do that. And that's all in the speech. So the reason I think the speech is so powerful is because that's really directly me talking to my late father and saying all the things that I couldn't really say. And you can't fake that stuff. That's not cynical. That's not engineered. Yeah. That's literally raw, honest pain and love coming through. And I think the reason that the film is connecting with people, ultimately, it's because it's joyous and it is happy and it reminds people of how great it is to listen to music for the first time, you know, when you're 16 years old. But also because it's been made with so much honesty and empathy. And I think people can recognize that. I think that comes off, you know.
I was also reminded at the fashion. God bless you guys.
Yeah. Is that
I got to miss
your current wardrobe?
I got to miss that.
All right.
Because, you know, again, teenager in the 90s, I have the, which has, to be fair to the 80s, I can clearly identify the 80s and 90s fashion. Kind of was just like a lack of, it was just plain,
I mean,
right?
To be honest, it was hilarious because I went on set on the beginning of April 2018 and the first day of shoot was the college scene.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all these extras dressed like from 1987. They have no idea what they're going, you know, because they weren't there, they weren't born, you know. And but it just looked like my childhood was being brought back to life, you know. It's absolutely extraordinary. The idea in a way was, what would a John Hughes film look like if it was filmed now and it was set in Luton?
Well, you point out how fantastic Vivek is in this movie. I also have to give a shout out to the mom who I wrote just because Mira, is it Ganatra?
Yes.
Mira,
yeah.
Just the look and the sort of tension, the unspoken emotions is just so good. She was so outstanding in this movie.
I mean, it's weird actually because I went home a couple of weeks after I saw the first time I saw it. Because I go home quite a lot, and I was with my mum, and it was really weird talking to her because I'm talking to her, and I kind of, you get used to a certain routine when you're with elderly parents. You know, they'll ask the same question, and they're sort of there and not quite there, you know. And you have, to be honest, you have a slight level of pity for them almost. You know, you're like, well, you know, I'm going to be there, I'm going to do my duty, but you know, there's not so much you can get back from them. But having just seen the film, I was like, oh my God, you know. You're that person. You're the person that was working till one in the morning. You're the person that sacrificed. You're the person that came from Pakistan. And seeing her life represented on a big screen, it really kind of blew me away. I was like, oh my God, you know, there's going to be screenings in Los Angeles and in New York and Seattle and Vegas, and people are going to get me moved by you. But you're that person. And I kind of had this newfound respect for her. So because she's kind of like, not really understanding any of this stuff. But I was just like, gosh, you know, all of this came back to you and my dad. And so it was a weird experience to see her again, having seen Mira play her.
If the movie wasn't so personal, it would not have been as good as I found it. Blinded by the Light, it's out right now. I absolutely adored this movie. I want everybody to see it.
This is a film that's been made with a lot of love, and you know, it's got a lot of heart to it. But ultimately, it works if people will turn up. So
yeah,
it would be great if people actually came out to see it.
Go see it this weekend. Blinded by the Light. Sofraz, thank you so much for coming by. I really appreciate it.
Great to talk to you.
You're listening to the Jason Rand Show. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show. Officer Adley Shepard was fired for excessive force in an encounter with an inebriated suspect. An arbitrator overturned the decision, giving him his job back. But now, just moments ago, a judge overturned the arbitrator. So now Officer Shepard is back without a job, and he joins me live. Adley, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
So obviously not the result you were hoping from this judge. Moments ago, Mayor Jenny Durkin and Seattle City Attorney Pete Holmes, they put out a statement, and in part it said, SPD should not be forced to employ an officer whose view of reasonable and necessary force is so immutable and so contrary to SPD's policies and values. What's your reaction to that?
Folks don't know. It's like the city already changed their policy because initially the policy that was in place at the time, it didn't conform to state law, and officers are allowed to protect themselves. And what folks don't understand is like, hey, getting kicked in the face and responding as you're trained and dealing with that pain and everything else, they just don't understand what I was dealing with, and they don't understand what officers deal with on a regular basis. Just by the city just using my, you know, my name and, my, and this incident as their, you know, strategic, you know, whatever they're doing. It's like they're wearing my name out, and I'm getting blamed for everything that happens in Seattle.
So do you think do you think this is being pushed for some sort of political purpose by Jenny Durkin and Pete Holmes?
Definitely. Jenny Durkin, she came in here with an agenda, first and foremost. The assault in me is the only assault in SPD, an assault on an officer was never investigated. I filed an OPA complaint 2.5 years ago asking why the investigation was, you know, why the assault on me was not investigated. And it's been delayed and held up. And Andrew Meyerberg, the now OPA director, he was the city attorney at the time who handled, the tort case. And now he's in that position. He took the case away from the chief for like 5 months. And I'm still waiting. Like, hey, why am I the only officer in SPD who was assaulted and investigation is not complete? And why are they not completing their investigation?
And to remind folks,
this whole thing has been a cover up, Jason, right from the gate, and it's been orchestrated.
Yes, and you and I have had this conversation on the show just a few months ago, and you know, just to remind folks what happened, you were arresting a suspect who kicked you in the jaw. You responded with a single punch. It was a hard punch, but it was the intent, to your point, was to subdue the suspect so you wouldn't continue to get kicked.
As I was trained, our head trainer, he went in there and he said, hey, he did it perfect, and he did exactly the way he was trained. All of SPD's witnesses that they used, they all agreed with me, that my force was necessary, reasonable, and within policy.
For the
city and the mayor and all doing this grandstanding, it's just, I just hope the feds come in here and really do some, like, hey, really dig into what's going on in the city.
What do you think is going on in the city? Because obviously this is being used to get in front of the federal consent decree.
Exactly. It's just corruption. And it's just, it's bad. It's getting worse. And just the way everything is orchestrated and the way it's playing out, we could all see it. It's like, you know, Pete Holmes is probably up there, you know, smoking up in his office right now, blowing, it's just a mess, Jason.
So what are your plans now that the judge has overturned the decision by the arbitrator?
Well, it's up to the city, and well, it's up to Smog, you know, whether or not, but this affects every officer on, this affects every union member in the city. And this is groundbreaking as far as what are our rights. And I believe in due process, and my due process, hey, that arbitrator heard a week's worth of oral arguments and evidence provided. And this, you know, this judge, he just took pieces of what he heard in the media or whatever. And even the way they kind of got to King County, it's like, it's just really shady.
Is this something that can be appealed?
I'm going to keep doing what I do. I'm going to keep fighting. I'm gonna stay high. They're gonna keep going low, but in the end, my story's never changed, and it'll stay consistent. I just hope the journalists out there actually really take the time and look into what's going on with this story from the beginning to end, and hear all sides.
Do you feel that the Seattle Police Officers Guild, the union, you felt like they've had your back this entire time, correct?
We've gone through a lot of union change. I believe my peers, no doubt about it. They've had my back 24/7. Every day I get calls, I get texts, just mad support. Because I haven't heard one officer that worked the streets that said that they would do anything different than I did. And that would be a great poll since the mayor loves polls, why don't you go to SPD and actually have a survey and have officers, street cops, and have them say, hey, who would respond differently?
Yeah.
I'd love to see those numbers.
I know it's a tough.
What I was dealing with.
I know it's a tough day for you today. Not the result you were hoping for. We'll have more information over at ktth.com and mynorthwest.com. We've been talking with Adley Shepard, now unfortunately a former officer within the SPD. We as always wish you the best of luck as you move forward. We have 10 seconds left. Final words, go.
Hey, keep fighting the good fight. The truth will prevail, and all the street cops are there. You guys be safe. I love you.
There you go. You've been listening to the Jason Rancho Live on AM 770 KTTH.